Scott Barchi. I took his classes when I was at UCLA, and they were wonderful experiences and were very influential on how I looked at early Christianity and social issues in early Christianity. He has his MA from the Harvard Divinity School, got a PhD from Harvard. He has taught at the University of Tübingen, and he now teaches at UCLA. He has written on slavery in early Christianity. He has written a book on slavery in 1 Corinthians. He's, I believe, working on a book on Acts. Is that correct right now? Okay. He has 2 children, 3 grandchildren, and I'm really, really pleased we're going to have a treat today. Thanks.
Thank you, Todd, and thank you for the invitation to speak at the Sunstone Conference. This is quite an honor for me, and I was delighted when Todd contacted me. Now, let me expand a little bit on what he was saying about me, to the extent that I understand my task as a scholar to be that of a scholar of the early Christians, to be that of trying to clarify to myself and then to pass along what I learned, how it was and why it was that this movement was able in the first place. What was it that made it electric? What made it catch on? What was happening to people psychologically and sociologically as they entered the Christian movement? And in a certain way, at least as interesting, if not more interesting, why were they still in it 5 years later? That is to say, what were the payoffs? For some philosophers, we might imagine that the payoff would simply be that of believing that they had discovered a system of truth. But we don't really find Christians arguing that way at the beginning. They seem to know a whole lot more about life categories than they do about truth categories, although eventually they have to face that. And if they're going to talk to the people of their world, the truth question becomes imperative. But at the beginning, it has to do with what it means to be a human being, what it means to live in human community, and a conviction about what God is doing in the world. So that's what I understand my broad task to be. And ever since I was a graduate student, I have found myself attracted then to those kinds of problems. So I'm a specialist in the relationship between religion and society in the Mediterranean, ancient Mediterranean world in general, and especially then where the Christians fit into that. Now, I come before you this morning really wearing at least 2 different hats that are relevant to my being here. One, I am confessing Christian, an active member of a house church, which I understand to be the only viable form of Christian social life. I have no time for what I call the standard brand congregations, except as a missionary where I'm invited to speak from time to time. because it seems to me that they talk a good game, but they really make the meat of it, namely being together in community, knowing each other really well enough, not only to pray for each other, but to loan each other money without asking too many questions. I mean, that's what's most holy in American society, right? I'm serious. There are many people where the other folks in the family don't even know what the other person is making at work. It is so holy, so sacred. In any case, those things which I have come to regard as central to the understanding and the practice of the Christian faith are made to be sort of the graduate course in too many congregations that it's nice if you get to it, but it's not essential for being there. So anyway, that's the one hat I wear. The other hat I wear is that of a historian. And as a historian, then the Christians get no special quarter from me. I mean, I have to look at the Christians the same way I look at the people out at the Dead Sea, the same way I look at the people that worshipped ISIS, the same way I look at the people who became Gnostic, the same way I look at the people that practice magic. That is to say, I have to look at the data and try to make sense out of it. And you don't, in the end, convince anybody by special pleading. Now, I have 2 choices this morning as to how to proceed, and Todd has already voted for the one. I take it that you will vote for that as well, but I just want to let you know. I do have a paper that I could read, but I find that to be a little deadly, even though that I understand that, you know, I understand that you're up for that and could stand that. and I go to many conferences where I read papers, but I'd much rather talk with you all if that's all right with you and if that's not a disappointment. If I can make copies of the paper available later, if that is really of interest. The paper takes a different tack, and it's than what I'll be doing here this morning in these next few minutes. Now, I understand that it would probably be the best thing for me to try to get through what I want to do by about 11 so that we have time for some feedback and questions. That means that I will be tempted to rush, and if I'm talking too fast, just raise your hand and go like this, and I'll come down. What I have laid out on the front and back of the handout, everybody has received a copy of the handout, I hope? All right. What I have laid out on the front and back of the handout would be enough for us to talk about that nonstop for the rest of the weekend. That is to say, there's enough data there for us to evaluate. The reason that I've put it out this way is not only so you can take it home and think about it, but also to indicate that there is an overwhelming mass of data that comes to us out of the early Christian documents in favor of the thesis that I'm going to present. And I have felt the need to do that because, especially since the time that the Christian church was made basically the religious arm of the state being the Roman Empire, the time being 391, the person being Theodosius the Great, since that time, values having to do with male and female relationships have become so confused in such a way, I would not only say confused, I would say at that time the door was left open for traditional values of the Roman family system to come rushing back in and to define the relationships between men and women in a way that the early part of the Christian movement had been seeking to overturn for centuries and was one of the primary reasons why the Romans took a special interest in persecuting them. That is to say, the Christians at the beginning are rejecting patriarchal society in the person of the authority of the oldest male in the family. And in the end, that will finally get back up to the emperor himself because, as you might imagine, after 500 years of being a republic, there had to be a tremendous public relations campaign to sell the idea that it was really going to take a one-man system, namely in the person of the emperor, to hold everything together. Now, economically and politically, that was true. It was going to take a much tighter control than what it had before during the Republic. But that didn't mean that everybody agreed with it, even though that were the case. And you all know Julius Caesar's story. They don't have to remind you. You stick out too far and you get hurt bad. But how then did the emperor sell themselves? I mean, how could they sell themselves to the average person? They sold themselves as the father of the fathers, the father of the country. And that somehow made it okay because for centuries, for as long as Romans could remember, the respect for the authority of the father was so high that even in highly developed Roman law, which was covering most everything having to do with persons, but especially with property, there was no law against a father killing his children up to the age of 18. That is to say, the patria potestas, the absolute authority of the father, included the power of death. Now, to be sure, a father would not rationally do that. But if a father got into an argument with a teenage son and struck him hard or became completely exasperated with his three-year-old and threw it to the ground and killed it, the neighbors would say, what a shame. But there was nothing against it. That is to say, the Christians came into a world that was characterized by not only male authority, but by the expectation that males would maintain that authority through whatever violence was necessary. In some way, that world is not much different from our own in principle. If you saw the news last night, you may have seen what I did, namely Donna Shalala giving a report to the country indicating that there will be as many women suffering severe violence from men, usually men who are quite close to them, there will be as many women suffering severe violence from men as there will be births in the coming year. It's anticipated that 4 million cases of serious violence, enough to take the woman to the hospital. The present statistics are that 3 out of every 10 women who appear in an emergency room are there because of domestic violence. And what has been documented is that we are no better in the religious community on the whole with respect to this than in the society generally. And it's even worse than that in some parts of the religious community in the United States. Unfortunately, in that part that I could say is most vocal these days about family values, quote unquote, the percentage of domestic violence has been shown to be higher than in the rest of the population. It's one of the ways in which religion really has made people and kept people sick. Now, at the beginning, I will make the argument it was not so, as is to the extent that people were listening to the traditions with respect to Jesus, and following the further elaboration of that by Paul of Tarsus. And I want to, and we can assume that they were. That is to say, we can assume that the people who were the producers of these texts and the preservers of these texts were by and large living by these texts. Otherwise, the Christians would not have been such an irritation to the Romans. As it is, the Christians would not have come to the place by the middle of the 3rd century when everything seemed to be hitting the fan in the empire. It almost bit the dust at that point. When, beginning in 251, there is an empire-wide systematic genocide program against all Christians, seeking to exterminate every last one of them and burn all their scriptures. Now, the fact that that had not been successful 60 years later is one of the factors in one of the most completely unexpected events that takes place in the ancient world, namely a Roman emperor, himself a military commander, who comes to power by violence, and who sustains himself by violence, decides, in light of the fact that you can't get rid of the Christians, that you ask them to join the party. And he becomes the patron of the Christians. That's a whole long story that is interesting in itself. What I want to focus on is the period prior to that. Now, as I say, there's enough material on the handout to keep us busy for a long, long time. So what I want to do is to make a couple of thesis statements and then fly over this, hitting down, and if you have some questions where you would like for me to go deeper, you know, when 11 o'clock comes in, let's do that. My basic thesis is that to ask the question about the role of women in the church or in the home is a completely inadequate question. As I say, it really is a sub-question to asking about the question of gender roles between men and women. And a bigger question than that is where is the power coming from? Who has it? Is it shared or not? As I say, the issue of gender roles is fundamentally a power issue. And whenever I've talked to men and women, and I've talked to thousands of them now in various denominations all across this country about this issue, I see people beginning to nod their head. It may have been the first time they thought about it. This whole thing has to do about power. It has to do with power perceived as control. That's where it is, and that's where we have to attack it, and that's what Jesus knew. Jesus has a reputation, rightly earned, for being a friend of the women in his society. He has a reputation rightly earned for having been a social deviant for that reason. When the charges are being leveled against Jesus in Luke 22-23 about what was wrong with what he did, and as that tradition goes down into the 2nd century, one of the great commentators, eventually he's asked to leave the Christian community because of a number of his ideas go off the edge, but one of the commentators by the name of Marcion says, and this appears then in one of the early manuscripts of the Gospel of Luke, that Jesus led women and children astray. Now, what that meant was that Jesus led women and children to think of themselves as independent from their fathers, and fathers don't like that. So let's start out with this first point, namely the historical Jesus' challenge to traditional sexual expectations and family values. I start then with what he has to say to men, because if anything is going to be changed, first of all, the men have to get it. If the men don't get it, then the women are going to be in serious trouble all along the way. There is a radical critique of patriarchy, of macho honor, and the use of power to dominate others. Now, the way in which you became, the way in which every young man was brought up in the ancient world, and far too many in the modern world are brought up this way, is to expect eventually to come to the place where he will be served. Now, he will be served at least by his children. If he can have his way, he'll be served by his wife in the way that he has been served by other women when he was a child, first of all, his mother. And then, if he's really a big man in our society, he'll be served by XYZ number of other men and women. Honor in our own society is generally given to the people who have the greatest control over the largest number of people, men and women. Indeed, the definition of patriarchy is not simply that of men lording it over women. It is that of certain men lording it over everybody, namely other men, as well as women. Now, we don't think that we should attain honor in our own society primarily, then, by a constant interaction with other males by challenge and response. We don't think so much that we're getting something on the man if we can figure out a way to get his wife into bed. But that was the way in which they thought in the ancient world, and even some of Homer's tales show that it went back to the earliest part of Greek folk tales, with the gods playing tricks on each other and getting their spouses to go to bed with them. Macho honor is that when, in a challenge response that can indeed involve violence, it may just involve insults, This is the primary way in which you become understood as a powerful person. And of course, at any time when somebody would be insulting you or anybody in your family, then that is something that you have to rise to. The MF word that is popular out of black culture, you're nothing but an MF, is an extension of exactly that way. You insult the rest of your family, and especially if you can insult the women in the family, that is considered to be the highest insult, and the man has to rise to it. He has no choice within that kind of a society. Power then is defined entirely in terms of domination. How much power you have is determined by who you can lord it over. Now let's just look at a couple of texts, some of which you might not have thought about had I asked you to brainstorm a bit about what we have in the early Christian documents that seem to address this. The parade example is one that Mark makes the climax of the first half of his narrative, namely in chapter 10, where, as Mark presents it, James and John come to Jesus and ask if they can't have the chief seats when Jesus comes into the kingdom. Now, they still are operating on the model. They grew up with little boys. They think that Jesus is pretty cool. Right now, he's incognito. But when he finally comes out and really takes charge of things, then they want the seats on the left and the right hand. Well, Jesus' first comment is, really, guys, the tickets for those seats aren't at sale at my window. God's in charge of this. But as a matter of fact, I have to ask you a question. Are you ready to be baptized with the baptism with which I'm baptized? That sounds a little redundant in English. In Aramaic, it has a real ring to it. You put the verbs in the nouns together, and it gets the emphasis. And these guys say, yeah, we're able. Now, I don't know if you've ever sung the hymn, Lord, We Are Able, if that's part of your tradition or not, but I sang that hymn as a teenager and thought that was a pretty interesting hymn. I can't sing it anymore because of what I know about this text. What these guys are saying, basically, not only that they're able, they're willing to do anything. They'll pay anything. They'll pay anything to get these seats. They see the future. They think that Jesus is going to be on top. And when he finally comes out with a big M on his chest and takes charge, then they want to be on either side. Well, the other 10 see that this is not going too well, and so they begin murmuring. They were all dying to ask the same question. They're all dying to ask the question. So Jesus gathers the whole bunch, and he says, now look, among the Gentiles, now he could have said almost the same thing about the Jews, but I think Mark is playing it out so the Gentiles get the message too. Among the Gentiles, it's this way, that those who insist that they be called benefactor, and that truth, that does heighten the irony, because indeed Gentile provincial governors did insist that they be called uergetes, that the people who are oppressing you are insisting that you call them your benefactors. And so he says, the people who oppress you call you your benefactors, and they put their thumb on you, and they screw you down into the ground, and that's the way the world is. But Mark is very bold. He doesn't say, sometime in heaven it'll be different. He doesn't say, 50 years down the road, when we finally get this movement under the way, it'll be different. He says, among you, it is not so. For the person who wants to be great among you will become your servant. And the one who longs so much now to be first, put himself last. And someone could say, well, that's fine, Jesus. You could go back and be with God and rule in heaven. You leave us around here to try to be servants. And so the text climaxes in Mark 10:45 when it says, for even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. Now, that's a highly ironical statement that would bypass anybody who doesn't understand something about Jewish expectation in the first century. The Son of Man is the one, according to the prophecy in Daniel 7:14, is the one whom God is going to designate to be the judge of the world. And even though there's an important debate about how the phrase Son of Man is used in the Gospel writers, it seems clear to me in the Gospel of Mark and what is happening here in the way in which Jesus is using it, it's meant as a reversal of values category, namely, I, who do accept the role of being the judge of the world, I'm judging the world and judging the way in which the world is using power and saying, I will use my power for the sake of others. Even though, according to all expectations, of course, you should be bowing down and Peter and James and John's question should be perfectly legitimate. Now, in order to try to get this across, that's great theory, isn't it? All right. Now, how did he plan to really implement this? Look at a couple of these other texts. There was a young man who came to Jesus and said, look, I need to go home and bury my father, and then I can come and be a part of your movement. Now, he didn't mean by that his daddy had just died and he had to go home for the weekend and be back on Monday. What he meant by that was he had to go home and be with his father. Now, that's what you did as a young man. You honored your father by going and be with your father to make sure your father had an honorable burial. So he's saying to Jesus, look, when I get my family business done, then I'll come and be with you. If there's any statement in these traditions that we have with respect to Jesus that has the highest degree of credibility for having been said by him, this is the one. It is such an ugly statement according to Roman family values. What does he say? Let the dead bury the dead. In terms of Roman family values, that is blasphemy. Now, Jesus knows, and you can figure it out for yourself, what will happen if this young man goes home and stays with his daddy until his daddy dies? What will happen when his daddy dies? He becomes the next patriarch. The system is just maintained on and on again. If the sons are going to go home until the daddies die, then the rule of God will never begin. Now, that sounds like hard bread to chew. But if you're trying to break up a patriarchal society that is symbolized on the local level in the experience of the so-called common people by the authority, the absolute authority of the father, then you have to have a way to hit it. Notice what happens in Mark. Peter, and this is the third point now. A person wanted to follow Jesus, and he really can't let go of control over his possessions, the control issue. The rich young man who couldn't follow Jesus, it wasn't that Jesus was inviting him into poverty. He says, come and be with us. He doesn't say, sell your stuff and give it to us, which would have been the case had he been joining the Qumran community. He says, no, that's really, that's what you said. Out there, you sold your stuff and gave it to the community. Jesus says, no, sell your stuff, give it to the poor, and come and be with us. The Jesus group was not poor in the sense that people's needs were not being met. And he goes away because he can't think of living without having control. I mean, that's what it means to be a man, doesn't it? To have control. And so Peter then leaps up, according to Mark's story. It's a great story. He says, look, you know, we've left everything to follow you. We've left fathers and mothers and houses and lands and brothers and sisters. What's going to happen to us? And Jesus says, well, Peter, there's no one who has left fathers and mothers, brothers and sisters, houses and lands, who will not have in this life, as well as in the next, mothers, brothers and sisters, houses and lands. I dare say there are a lot of readers of the Gospel of Mark that don't notice what's going on there. But you've just noticed what is missing in what Jesus promises. No fathers. No fathers when God is ruling. Now, he's talking about not biological fathers, he's talking about patriarchal fathers. There's another tradition that is also very shocking. I first heard about it in terms of Roman Catholic, anti-Roman Catholic propaganda. Don't call anybody father, and they do, so they're bad guys. But in Mark, we have a tradition in Matthew 23 in which, once again, in the framework of Jesus talking about using your power for the sake of others, check the context for yourself, he says, call no man father. It's really eating at the heart of males using power for themselves alone. One more thing, and then I have to go on from there because it's already 20 till. Another text that fits in here that I think has been radically misunderstood is Jesus' claim on the lips of Jesus, at least in Matthew 5. It says, turn the other cheek. You know that one? Now, it's interesting, you know, the text does not say, when they kick you in the groin, you're still like a little higher so that they can really do a good job. You know, what's this business about turning the other cheek? This is macho honor system. It doesn't hurt you all that bad if somebody slaps you on the cheek. It stings. It doesn't hurt you physically. But sure as hell is a challenge to who you are as a man. In the general way, if somebody did that either verbally or physically, you had to fight. No questions asked. You had to respond. You really had to respond. And what Jesus is remembered to have counseled is, hey, you know, you can break that cycle of violence. You don't have to be a male in that sense. You know, turn the other cheek. It'll confuse the hell out of them, really will. I mean, they won't have any idea what's going down. You know, and if they want to steal your coat, then let it go. You can get another coat. He wasn't saying it's better to live without a coat. He's just saying it's not worth fighting about. All right. Now, the challenge then, I'm down here to 1:2. The challenge to males is to use their power to serve and honor others. I've already referred to the text in Mark 10:45, for the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve. In John 13, servants are not greater than their master. The master has just been one who has washed their feet. You may remember this story. I think it's elaborated in a theological meditation in John, but there's a historical kernel there. Now, why isn't it that Peter doesn't want Jesus to wash his feet? It's not that his feet didn't need it. It was because he knows, hey, this is not right. You know, if the person I've been following as the master is going to get down on his knees in front of me and wash my feet, I'm in trouble. Because I know what Jesus is saying. Of course the servant is not greater than the master. If I follow Jesus all this long to be a foot washer the rest of my life? Yeah. Well, the answer is yes. All right, the rejection then of religious status, of sexual taboos. According to the purity system that was becoming more wide and widespread in the first century, a menstruating woman was considered to be not only unclean but untouchable. This purity system was being reinforced very strongly by the powerful renewal program that had sought that the Pharisees had sought to start about 150 years before. And so the woman that we have here talked about in Mark 5 is an especially a poignant example of a woman who was not simply menstruating. That is to say, it was considered to be unclean to have sexual intercourse with a menstruating woman. It was considered to be unclean to touch her. It was considered to be unclean to have her handle food during the time that she was menstruating. Okay, so now we have a woman who has been who had a flow of blood for 12 years. So she has been untouchable for 12 years, which doesn't mean that nobody touched her. It just means that those who did also became unclean. And she has what we would call today a very, very low self-esteem. So how does she handle it? You know, I mean, you have people on Jesus' path, guys who are sitting there, you know, blind Bartimaeus and others who are sitting there and say, Jesus, over here, you know, come and help me. This woman doesn't have a voice anymore. So what does she do? She comes up through the crowd and thinks, well, if I can just touch him, I know I can, that will help. If I can just touch him. And so she comes and just touches his clothes. And this marvelous story, the story says that power flowed out of Jesus into her and she was healed and he sensed it. So he looks around in the crowd and to the people, the guys who were with him, and he says, who touched me? And the disciples say, what? You expect us? You know, we're not mind readers. Who touched you? How can we figure that? All this milling crowd, you want to know? He wasn't asking them. He was asking for the woman who touched him to identify herself. Who touched me? Who touched me? And what probably was the humiliation on top of the other humiliations for her, she finally said, well, it was me. Falls down in front of him. He lifts her up and he calls her daughter. As I say, he owns that. He says, okay, you did it thinking that I wouldn't like it. I'm going to tell you, I touched you. And I want everybody to know it. I touched you. You're a menstruating woman and I touched you. It's okay. You're a daughter of Israel. Okay, rejection of the double standard for male and female sexual behavior. It was generally understood that if there was a sexual problem, that was a woman's fault. To say, men, boys were raised to think that they didn't really have to control their passions. It was up to the men, up to the women to do that. And that was still being said to young people when I was in high school. It was, you know, if the girl got pregnant, it was her fault, right? And boy, my father fortunately took me aside and gave me some warning. He said, look, I don't want you, you need to be careful and make sure that the baby that you have is really a baby you want to have with the person you want to have it. So here's some things you need to know. A lot of fathers didn't say that to their sons, and so we did have a number of pregnant girls in my high school, and we know that that is, has come now to epidemic proportions in the United States today. What Jesus attacks this business is that it's the woman's fault. And really says to the men, look, you are responsible for what your eyes do, for what your hands do, for what your mind does. And he's very strong. He says, look, if you're lusting after that woman and it's only the honor of her husband or of her father or the fact that you don't have opportunity, if that's the only thing that's keeping that lady out of your bed, then the best thing you ought to do is to tear your eye out. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out. And he says, if your right hand is causing you to sin, cut it off. Now, it's high-powered language, but his point is that the men are responsible for their behavior. They can't say, oh, you know, she was so gorgeous, I just couldn't help myself. John 8 is another example of this. You remember the woman the woman who's caught in adultery, right, and brought to Jesus? Remember the story? Now, has it ever occurred to you that she's not caught masturbating, is she? Huh? She's caught in adultery. What does that mean? She was with a guy. Presumably, she was with a guy. So we don't know. You know, Jesus never writes anything is one of the frustrations for us to try to find out something about the historical Jesus. He doesn't write anything. But here we have this perplexing thing where it says he did write something. It was in the sand. I mean, come on, Jesus. Write on something at a last, you know. But what did he write in the sand? What did he write in the sand? Well, we'll never know, right? But use your imagination. Huh? Try this one on for size. What did he write in the sand? Where's the man? You guys want to blame her? Where's the man? And so he turned. It's all guys, you know, brother. It's not, there's not a woman in the crowd, apparently. These guys, it's her fault, right? It's her fault. And so he just says, well, all right, you know, which one of you, if you hadn't had a chance to be with her, or with somebody else? Yeah. First person here was without sin, you cast the first stone. The crowd disappears. All right. Rejection of the double standard. In what Jesus has to say about divorce, the important thing to notice here for what we're doing is that he sets the same standard for men and women. That is to say, sexual fidelity is expected of the man as well as of the woman. Now, in the ancient world, even among the Jews, a man who was married could sleep with somebody else who was not married to somebody else. That is to say, he could sleep with a woman who was not married. It was not considered to be very good family manners, but it was not considered adultery, and it was barely considered a sin. And in the Greco-Roman world, as long as you brought the money home and raised the kids, sleep with as many people as you can get into bed, if you're a man. Now, the woman is supposed to be faithful. Why? So that the man can know that the kids are his. Jesus tears that whole thing down, and that is what's memorable. He just says, he levels the playing field between men and women. There can be no power games here on this issue. Rejection of traditional female gender roles, creation of new public roles for women. A lot of these stories you already know. I'm just trying to line them up for you here in a way that I think really becomes an overwhelming bundle of data. Mary and Martha, you know, there's nothing wrong with serving. Jesus himself serves. But if the women in the early church, and that's one of the reasons why this story was preserved, because the debate goes on, if the women in the early church saying, look, what we really need to do is to learn how to run the kitchen better, that's the best way to serve in the church. Mary stands there and sits there at the foot of Jesus, learning, fulfilling the role of a man, becoming a disciple of Jesus, and Jesus is remembered to have said she's chosen the best part. There'll always be somebody to fix supper. The question is, who really has the dedication to understand the Word of God? We learn from Luke that there were women, traveling companions of Jesus and patrons. I mean, this is a young, attractive man in his early 30s. And you can imagine what's being said. I mean, he's not traveling around with guys alone. There's girls in the group, too. And some of them are people of some means. And why aren't they home attending to their husbands or looking after their fathers or whatever? There was a woman who thought that she got it. I mean, she was really admiring Jesus. I'm now to point three. And so she comes at one point, according to Luke, and she says, and this was considered to be a wonderful thing to say. She said, blessed is the womb that bore you and the breast that nursed you. You know, that's not insulting your family, right? That is heaping praise on your family. And it's not saying nasty things about your mother. It's saying wonderful things about your mother. And how does Jesus reply? Blessed is the one who hears the word of God and does it. He refuses even to allow Mary to be defined in terms of being his mother. Now, Mary will be remembered in the early church as a particularly ideal disciple, namely one who accepted the word of God and became a servant of that word, both in accepting Jesus in her womb and becoming a disciple afterwards. But that was what made her great. What made her great, as far as the book of Acts is concerned, is she was one of the disciples, not because she was his mother. In John 4, we have one you want to talk about, namely the most extensive discussion, theological discussion that Jesus has with any human being in the New Testament is with a woman, and not only with a woman, but with a Samaritan woman, let's say with one of those people, and not only with that, but with a woman who had now five husbands, and the present one doesn't have is not her husband. So she has three strikes against her. And what is interesting is that it says that the people in her village believe because of her word. And in the Greek, it's precisely the same phrase that is in the famous prayer of Jesus in 17:20, in which he says, he prays for those who will believe through the disciples' word. That is to say, she is the first evangelist in the Gospel of John. By the way, also in the Gospel of John, it is Mary and Martha who first of all confess that Jesus is the Messiah. It's not first of all Peter. Very interesting tradition. Luke 15 has a female figure used metaphorically for God. Jesus is doing this kind of stuff as well. And it's all across the board that in the gospel material, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the first witnesses to the resurrection are women, which is extraordinarily countercultural. Generally speaking, the testimony of women was not considered to be valid in court, except to testify that somebody else really was a widow. Certain limited cases where a woman's voice counted. Which may be the reason, by the way, that I suggest here in 1 Corinthians 15, where in the famous tight presentation of the gospel on the in the writings of Paul, that he says that the first witness is Peter. I mean, he drops out really the first witness, perhaps because it was meant to be a list that would be regarded as, quote, legally valid, the testimony of women. would not have counted in society. Now, well, as a conclusion then to the Jesus material, I'd like to suggest two things to think about with respect to this initial, what we regard as historians as the earliest of the Christian confessions, namely Jesus is Lord. If Jesus is really Lord, I think what was being understood at the beginning was that only Jesus can be Lord, nobody else. Not your father, not any other male figure, not even the emperor. All patriarchs, rulers, and dominations are tumbled from their thrones. And that's part of what made the Christians really very suspicious people in the empire, and finally why they tried to eliminate them. The other side of it is, though, that if the Lord is Jesus, then legitimate power seeks not to control others and things, but to empower the powerless, to lift up the fallen, to reconcile, to create healing opportunities, to encourage maturity and responsibility, to restore community. And if you note what is here, and I can tell you a long story about this, but there's not time, this kind of power exists in unlimited supply. There's more power out there to do that kind of thing than any of us have ever asked for. Whereas the power to control, of course, is in limited supply, and people scramble for it. I'm convinced that this kind of power, the power that is in unlimited supply, that one of the ways in which the early Christians talked about this was the power of the Holy Spirit. And now, if I had a board here, I was told I would have one, but if I had a board here, what I would say is this. That, you know, the word Lord is a half a term, just like the word father is half a term. You can't be a father without a mother. You can't be a parent without a child. You can't be a Lord without a servant. And what I would argue here is if this is the Lord circle and this is the servant circle down here, what happens is that Jesus, for the early Christians, he completely occupies the Lord circle. There's no space for anybody else, not even for the husband anymore. Okay. But when it comes time to operating himself, he doesn't operate out of the lordship circle. He comes down and operates out of the servant circle. And he invites everybody else to join him there in an egalitarian community of service. All right, now, turned the page over. I set up the second side, and I'll go 10 minutes here. I set up the second side purposely, and this was the fun for me yesterday in thinking about coming to you all. I have not used this handout just this way before. What I tried to do, I took the outline for my first side. I'm going to say now, just for the sake of the argument, what I'm going to test is to see how much of the material out of the Pauline literature can fit into the same outline, because so often they say, well, yeah, Jesus did this, but Paul really was a male chauvinist pig, and he really lost it, and what he has to say about women then is really bad, etc., etc. But let's watch what happens. The radical critique of patriarchy, macho honor, and the use of power to dominate others. First of all, in a text that has suffered one of the most violent turnovers in its meaning of all the New Testament texts, namely Ephesians 5, the thing that is so powerful about that is not what it's saying to women that they should that they should subordinate themselves to their husbands. It is just said that anybody who is filled with the Holy Spirit will subordinate himself to each other. In fact, the famous text in Ephesians 5:22, it says, "Women to your husbands as to the Lord," doesn't even have a verb in it. It has to go back to the previous verse 21, where it says that all Christians who are filled with the Spirit are supposed to be subordinating themselves to each other, because the Spirit is one of service. Okay, but what is really so extraordinary about what happens in Ephesians 5 is it says, "Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her." Now, I've heard lots of teachers talking about Christian values in male and female relationships, and they'll say, this means that the husband is supposed to be the head of the house. The text doesn't say anything about being the head of the house. It does talk about a word for head, which is kephale, but which is being used metaphorically here for source, and we can come back to that if that interests you. What is important here to say is that husbands love your wives just as Christ loved the church. It doesn't say husbands lord it over your wives the way in which Christ lords it over the church. You love your wives the way in which Christ loved the church and gave his life for her. That is to say, laid down his power for her sake. Now, I could wish as a husband that he hadn't been quite so frank about that, because that's it. But it does, you know, I want to ask, you know, what part of that English sentence don't we understand? But the same thing now, he's hitting now this idea of male dominance. Now, Colossians 3, "Fathers, do not provoke your children or they may lose heart." We don't read that anywhere else in the ancient world. Fathers, don't provoke your children. I mean, what do you have children for? If you can't provoke them every now and then. Now, it's interesting, it doesn't say the mothers, be sure to raise the kids right, because after all, you're the ones in charge. This is addressed to fathers. In 1 Corinthians 6:7, people are taking each other to law courts. He says, now look, come on. You know, out of the Christian community, they're taking each other to law courts. He said, "Yeah, you're playing the old power games with each other." He says, "Why not rather be wrong? To maintain the integrity of the community, let's get our priorities straight here." In 1 Thessalonians 5:12, a very powerful passage, namely, respect those who labor among you. He's talking to the Thessalonians about their leaders who don't look like leaders in the old sense because they're serving. And they're not asking for honor in the old sense because they're serving. And so Paul has to look as the outside observer who called them into existence through his message and an example in the first place. He said, please respect those people. Now, a challenge then to males and females to use their power to serve and honor others. This is all over the place in the Pauline literature. Romans 12:10. Transform minds, show that they're transformed by how? Outdoing each other in showing honor for the others. Or Philippians 2:1-10. In humility, regard others as better than yourselves. That is said to be the chief sign that you have the mind of Christ. That is the chief sign of having the mind of Christ. And then look, in 1 Thessalonians, this is lovely. He says to these same people, in the Thessalonians, what is your power for? To admonish the idler, admonish the idlers, maybe the elders too, but the idlers here. Encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak, be patient with all of them. Yeah, isn't that lovely? Rejection of religious sexual taboos. This is absolutely extraordinary. In 1 Corinthians, Paul in 1 Corinthians 7:1 begins answering the questions that the Corinthians have written to him in a letter. And the first thing they want to ask, there's some people who have gotten some what they think is really spiritual input, and they say, wouldn't it really be better if we would just shut down sexual intercourse in marriage? He said, wouldn't it be better if a man didn't touch a woman, which is a euphemism for sexual intercourse? And Paul writes back and says, well, because of your sexual behavior, and he's already been talking about that in chapter 5 and 6, so this is not generally the first thing he says in answer to a question like that, but you have a guy sleeping with his stepmother in chapter 5, you have people going to prostitutes and saying, hey, that really does not have anything to do with my spiritual life because basically I leave my mind at home and just take my body down there. And Paul says, look, your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit. Let's get one thing straight. Then, so with this question, he's saying, look, you know, in light of what's going on in your congregation, remember that we've had a few problems here, haven't we? But then he goes ahead to say something that I'll talk about in a moment. Here I'm just trying to stay true to these categories, rejection of religious status of sexual taboos. It was always understood that within the marriage, the person who dominated, especially on the Greco-Roman world, while Paul is here in Corinth, that the person who not only dominated in the sense of actually having the power, but the person who created the character of what life was going to be like in the home, also in relationship to the gods, was the husband. The general advice was to the wife, honor your husband's gods. Okay, yeah, that's one of the ways to get along. What does Paul say here in 1 Corinthians 7, 12 through 15? Namely, that it's not only the case that an unbelieving wife can be accepted by a believing husband, and that she, you know, that once again, that she will not defile the marriage. But he turns it back around and says that the believing wife, the Christian wife, has enough spiritual gumption now, has enough spiritual power, that she basically defuses the uncleanness of her husband. Now, it doesn't mean that he's become a Christian. You don't become a Christian against your will. But it means that she can be there with him if he's willing to stay. If he'll take her now the way she is. Now, I'm saying this is absolutely revolutionary. There's nobody that talks this way in the ancient world, neither among the Jews nor among the Greeks, to say that a woman can set the spiritual ambiance for the marriage. Category 4, rejection of traditional female gender roles, creation of new public roles for women. Paul talks about a number of people who are very important in his ministry. Phoebe is not a deaconess. There were no deaconesses in the experience of the early church until about the 4th century. She is called with the male term deacon. That is to say, she is a minister. Now, the old King James Version noted that those translators living in a time where to be a minister, to be sure, in England, was to be a big dude. The minister of the exchequer, the minister of the foreign affairs, and so forth. They translate this word, diakonos, 18 times with the word minister. And everybody in that context thinks, well, that means the one person here is up in charge of our congregations, right? The minister. Three times. 18 times they say minister, 3 times they transliterate it, namely they say deacon. And of course, deacon means so many things in the Christian world, you don't know what a deacon does until you see him deek. I mean, you have to watch, right? Right? In the Baptist church, the deacon is basically the elders. And I know some other churches where the deacon is down at the bottom, so you don't know. The word simply means servant. There's only one person in the King James Version that is called what the world literally means, namely, you know who? Phoebe. She gets to be called a servant. Now, either everybody is ministers or everybody is servants. You can't mess around with words that way. She's also called a patron, which means that she's a house church leader. Priscilla is called a co-worker. And perhaps most astonishing, there is a woman by the name of Junia in Romans 16:7 who is called by Paul outstanding among the apostles. What? A woman apostle? Could that possibly be true? Why haven't I heard that before? The reason you haven't heard that before is because a 13th century Latin writer by the name of Aegidius, reading this text and not knowing anything about Greek names, said, well, here's Junius and Andronicus, relatives of Paul, or at least Jews, outstanding among the apostles. They must have been really great guys. And from that point on, you know, apostles are men, right? Apostles are men. And so there had to be a man. Fortunately, there was a young woman who now is teaching at Harvard, who spent a year and a half of her life researching ancient names, and showed that there's as much chance of a man being named Junia in the ancient world as there is of a man being named Judy in the first century, in our century. It could be done, but statistically, you know, it's negligible. This person is a woman, and she is an apostle, just as much as Paul uses that language for himself, for Barnabas. Now, she wasn't one of the 12. We can talk about the 12 if you like. In fact, I want to do that at some point. But she is called out, not just an apostle, but outstanding among the apostles. And even such a person who proves himself really not to be much of a friend of women down in the late 4th century, the great preacher of Constantinople by the name of John Chrysostom, John the Golden Mouth, when he's commenting on this text, he said, wow, you know, this woman must have been a dynamite woman, loosely translated. She must have been a dynamite woman, not only been an apostle, but to be outstanding among the apostles. He knew, first of all, as a native Greek speaker, that Junia is the name for a woman. Okay, and secondly, it was blowing his mind that she was said to be great, but there it was, right there in the text. Okay, women as prayers and prophets, leaders in prayer. 1 Corinthians 11 makes that very clear. That is one of the most problematic passages in all the Pauline literature, but one thing is absolutely clear. There were women in the congregation who were praying and prophesying. And the radio preacher told me one time, I was listening to him, he said, now these girls, as he called them, huh? These girls prayed and prophesied at home, and then their daddy took it to the church. Now he's thinking entirely anachronistically. All the churches of the first century are house churches. So where, you know, where did they pray and prophesy? In the bathroom? And then, you know, their dad, come on, you know, forget it. In Philippians, Paul calls Judea and Syntyche his co-workers, not his subordinates. Paul is a big, big fan of co kind of language, a co-worker, co-disciple, so forth, and he calls these ladies co-workers. 1 Corinthians 11:5, we can come back to. Creation of radical equality in marriage. Here is another thing that is absolutely a unicum. In the first century, Paul says, when he's advising them about marriage, they've asked whether or not they really shouldn't shut down sexual intercourse also in marriage. He says, no, you shouldn't. Every woman generally should have a husband. Every man generally should have a wife. And he says, the husband should not withhold himself from his wife, nor the other way around. Then he says, for the woman does not have authority over her body, and he uses a word for body that we would say today would be include the personality. The woman does not have authority over the body, but the man does. And then he says, homoios, for Greek, in the very, very, very same way. The man does not have authority over his self, we might say, but the woman does. Now that is still tough bread. For a lot of people in the 20th century, you can imagine what it was for people in the first century. Now, we could have wished, I've had dialogue with some feminists who would say, well, Scott, this whole property thing really puts me off. I mean, they want Paul not only to jump over his shadow, but to jump out of his skin. It's not enough for them that he equalizes it within the terms that he can understand. You know, they want him to get rid of property as well. Maybe that's what we have to do, but I'm a little bit expecting too much of his. The point is here that we have radical egalitarianism, and I've had also people say to me, well, you know, that's just with respect to sex. Now, with respect to other things, I want to say, how long have you been married? You know. The counselors tell us that if married people can agree on what they're going to be to each other sexually and how they're going to spend their money, you know, that they're 90% of the way towards having a wonderful marriage the rest of their life. The rejection of traditional gender roles while insisting on the goodness of sexuality. Now, this is something where Paul has been misunderstood over and over again, because Paul later on is used then as the model in the Roman Catholic Church for saying that really, if you're going to be a leader, you need to be celibate. Right? And that's a whole long story. What is misunderstood here is the subtlety of what Paul is saying, and it is radical. He is saying in this chapter, you don't have to be married in the Christian congregation to be a real person. Now, that's something that needs to be said in our society. Excuse me, it needs to be said in our churches as well. Huh? You don't have to be married. You don't have to get pregnant to be a person around here. You don't have to have a son to really be highly respected. Huh? A single person has status. Now, that's new. But he's not ragging on the people who are married. He said, no, you know, listen, singleness, he says, is not something that can be regarded as an achievement. Huh? See? It's not an achievement. He says, if you're burning, get married. Now, he didn't say, if you're burning, He's not a Victorian. He simply says, if you have strong sexual feelings, get married. It's no sin. He says, it's no sin. And it was precisely because there were people who were trying to be what they weren't. And that's still going on, as we know from reading the newspaper and over again. We have these celibate priests who are messing around with kids. It's bad enough that they're sleeping with their housekeepers, although I have a much higher respect for that, because many of them would marry their housekeepers if the bishop would let them. The bishop knows they're sleeping with their housekeepers, but won't let them marry. But when they start messing around with kids, they really get under my skin. Now, why are they doing that? Because they were tempted as teenagers to give their lives to Jesus and thought that's what it was required. And they didn't have the gift. Now, what is the gift that Paul is talking about? It's not just the gift of being satisfied with yourself as a single person. The gift is that you have your singleness for the sake of the community. The singleness is an opportunity to serve. Whenever he uses the word gift, he's talking about that which is given not as a sign of God's grace to you personally, but as a sign of God's grace to the community through you. Okay, then a historical perspective for reflecting on Pauline texts. How do we sort this out? This is original with me, but you're welcome to use it in anywhere that it can be a benefit. We've got texts that look like they conflict with each other. One place Paul tells women not to speak in the assembly, and another place in the Pauline tradition not to teach a man. And those after the Theodosian establishment of the church of the 4th century, when Roman hierarchical values come rushing back into the church, then become about the only texts that anybody knows on this subject. But where do they fit? In light of all this other information on these two sheets, where do they fit? Well, I think they have to be categorized as corrective texts. There was something going on there that needed to be regulated. And it doesn't surprise me. It really surprises me that there weren't more. This is a more, when women now are brought into a community and treated as equals, they're going to make some mistakes. They haven't had the training. They haven't had the experience. They haven't been used to being leaders. And it surprises me that there aren't more problems. But what is clear is that the greatest number of texts having to do with women in the New Testament literature have to do with them doing stuff in public. That is to say, simply describing it. Not complaining about it, just saying that they were doing it. Junia is an apostle. It doesn't say that's great. It doesn't say that it's terrible. It just says that she is one. In Acts 18, we have Priscilla being described as being one of the teachers of Apollos. Apollos was not a 12-year-old kid the way you would have to be in some congregations. He was a grown man, sophisticated theologian from Alexandria, and Priscilla is mentioned first. Now, she was not out in the kitchen fixing the tea, the way I was told. She was in there teaching him the Word of God more perfectly. And that, according to Luke, is just after she has been to graduate school with Paul. They've been hanging out with Paul and building tents and listening and hearing what they're supposed to do. Read Acts 18 for yourself. So, the vast majority of texts are descriptive of women doing the stuff that we've just been talking about. We can assume, then, that such texts as Galatians 3:28, namely, neither male nor female in Christ, which many people throughout the history of the church have said, well, that means that God loves all of you equally, but here at home, honey, I'm in charge, or in the church, it's the men that's going to be in charge, you know, that it really doesn't count there. In the first century, it did count. This kind of instruction that we get from Galatians 3:28 or Acts 2:17 and 18, your sons and daughters shall prophesy, resulted in the Phoebes, in the Priscillas, in the Junias, in the Euodias, in the Syntyches, and the reason it could is because the men in question had heard Jesus and were willing to start using their power for the sake of others rather than to lord it over anybody, including the women. Okay, we have 5 minutes for questions. What do you think? Does that fly or not? Thank you. Excuse me. Yes?
I have a question or a control.
They could... Sure, but they could leave it at any time, right? I mean, nobody had to do it.
Right.
Jesus is not making decisions for anybody. I mean, he could have saved Peter and the rest a whole lot of trouble if he had just made their decisions for him.
Sometimes I get the feeling that people who say these sorts of
things... Yeah, in a patriarchal society. I mean, if women generally had gone out... the anomaly, of course, are these women that we meet in these early texts. I mean, we don't expect them in a patriarchal culture. You know, if women have gone out and saying, look, what you all are supposed to be is servants, they'd say, well, of course, that's what we expect you to be. You know, someone asked me one time, could the incarnation have worked just as well in a female body? No. Why? Because it had to be shown in a male body that this is how God is operating in the world. If a female body had been doing this, they said, what else is new, honey? We have some more things for you to do. As soon as you finish polishing my shoes, then we've got 10 others here we want you to do. See what I'm saying? Now, I think that what you ask a very important question, namely the question of authority. the question of authority. Now, how is authority then going to be communicated and sustained within the Christian community? Are there any limits? Of course. It has to do with Jesus himself, first of all, making clear who God is and what God is trying to get done and what the limits will be. You can be in that community if that's what you're up to. And if you're not up to that, then you're going to have to leave. If you've come in here to try to get us on another track, I'm sorry, you have to go. The Marcion that I mentioned came from a very wealthy family in the middle of the 2nd century to Rome. His daddy was a shipbuilder in Sinope up on the Black Sea. When he came into the congregation, he brought along with him 10,000 sesterces. The average daily wage was about 4 sesterces, so that's a lot of money. 10 years later, when it became clear that he could not accept the Hebrew Scriptures, because he said, well, the Father of Jesus is a lot better than the God of the Old Testament, when he insisted on thinking philosophically rather in terms of the historical narrative, when he began to question whether or not the creation was really good, a number of things like that, they said, Marcion, that's it. You know, that's it. You've got to go. And they gave him his money back. See? Now, that's the use of authority. But I think the point is, for me, how Paul himself is regarding in 1 Thessalonians, the people who are working there are operating with a kind of a countercultural authority. It's the authority of the power of their own example. And and whether or not a person has authority is whether or not they have in them already the example, whether they can demonstrate in their own culture who Jesus is. So in 1 Timothy 3, one of the texts that's been used over and over again to order church life among Christians anyway, the things that are being asked of bishops and deacons there are simply demonstrations that in that culture that they've got their own lives under control, that they really have learned something about what it means to be a Christian, that they can teach, that they're hospitable, that they have a good relationship with their kids, on and on and on. But all of these things are simply saying that these are some people who already know the way. I mean, the leaders are the ones who know the way. No, absolutely not.
He was teaching a leadership style.
Exactly, absolutely. Sure. Sure, he's not saying, he doesn't say, look, it's an evil thing to want to be first. He never says that. He says, if you want to be first, then you figure out how to serve. No, and it's interesting, I've heard people, you know, there's a friend of mine who wrote a book on the egalitarianism of the Corinthian congregation. I think that's foolishness. If by egalitarian you mean that everybody's the same. No. No way. You read the letter itself, Paul is all the time, in sometimes confusing ways, talking about the strong and the weak. You know, he knows that there are people that are strong, some people who are weak. This causes tensions. What does he say to these people, though? You know, it's not an egalitarian community in the sense that there are no differences between the people. He knows that there are a lot of differences between the people. So what does he say to them? Barchi's summary. You know, what does he say to them? The strength of the strong will be measured by their willingness